Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, Mark, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. 2016 was, it seemed like a very long year, longer than most.
It was, I can say that. It was a very long year in one respect. And I think the elections kind of dominated everything.
I would certainly agree. I know we've both had conversations both on the microphone and off the microphone of what's going to happen, what we didn't think would happen, and now what has happened and what could happen coming in the future. So, yeah.
That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. And what a great way to kind of end that year. And we'll see what comes in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, the year ended on an exhausted note for most immigration attorneys because there was a deadline, which, thank you, USCIS, was put one day before Christmas. And most clients being clients always leave everything to the last minute. So I know we were crazy, and I know most immigration attorneys were going crazy. And from the speed that USCIS, or rather the length of time they're taking to just take in receipt notices, I think USCIS went crazy as well.
I can imagine. I know that we didn't have an episode that went out in December, but judging by our show downloads, more people were listening in December than previous months. So I think... Yeah, people missed us and they were going crazy as well and were listening to our voice, even though we weren't here on the microphone talking because people were busy as well.
Right. Well, today's show, we are just going to do a review of 2016 for all the things that people might have missed and a few discussions. It kind of overlaps to 2017. And to join me, I have Rebecca Singh and Omar Hakim.
Hi, Mona and Mark. Happy New Year to you.
Hi, everyone. Happy New Year. And we're looking forward to 2017.
Hey, Omar. Hey, Rebecca. Glad to have you on again.
Long time, Mark.
It has been.
We kind of keep Omar back, you know, because SEC usually is one of those areas which you really need to be thinking and listening.
Exactly. Either you have to be very quiet or you have to be very boisterous, disclosure-ish. I'm making up verbs now, so sorry, Omar.
Well, so Mark, we're going to start with having a quick look at what Congress did in 2016, which wasn't an awful lot, but at the same time, there were some significant factors that they did do. The most important thing is that it was a busy year for Congress. Well, it wasn't really a busy year for Congress this year. We're expecting next year to be a busy year, or rather 2017 to be a busy year, because they just continued four immigration programs, and the main one being the EB-5 program. And that was extended up until April 28, 2017. There were three other programs that they extended as well, Rebecca, right?
Yes, they did. They extended the E-Verify, the Conrad State 30J1 waiver program, and the Special Immigrant Non-Minister Religious Worker program.
So these are small programs which were all up for renewal, and those were extended. None of them as controversial, I suppose, as EB-5. But one of the big issues which happened last year when Donald Trump did win was that a lot of immigration attorneys were really worried about things like DACA. What happened there, Rebecca?
So for those that don't know what DACA is, I don't want to go into full detail. We could probably get into another podcast. But DACA stands for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And that emanated from the DREAM Act, which has been ongoing for years at this point. That was a way to lead for citizenship for those who arrived here, underage, without any provided with any help.
But the DREAM Act never went through,
yeah. So unfortunately. But President Obama, he had put in the executive order, which is not law, unfortunately, but it was a way to help these kids in providing a way for them to continue their education and to also gain employment. And that way they're not hiding and they can come out. So what happens now, what we're scared is because it's not in law, we're afraid that President Trump might go ahead and discontinue this program.
That would be a real shame.
It really would be. About 740,000 DACA applicants are out there. So we would be doing a tremendous disservice to all these kids who came in, again, without any, you know, any fault of their own. So fortunately, though, we do have a new bill was proposed. It's Bill 3542, or which we call the Bridge Act.
And the good thing about this bill is that it's bipartisan.
Yes, yes, exactly. So it was introduced by two senators, Senator Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin. And what they're also trying to do is they want to protect all these undocumented individuals if the program for DACA is discontinued. So we have much hope for that. We're hoping that if it does, they can come up with this. It's called the Bridge Act again, and it stands for the bar removal of individuals who dream and grow our economy. So we're hoping this goes through because those kids, as I said, 740,000, they're making a difference in the economy. So we look forward to seeing this going through if the DACA is discontinued.
Certainly. I would agree and echo that as well. I know a few of these dreamers, you know, that's mm-hmm. what we call them short, the dreamers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were kids when they came over through no fault action on their own. Their parents just bring them over. But now they've grown up. So I know a couple of them are here working legally under the DACA program. And yeah, they were kind of, you know, fearing some, you know, risk or retribution. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is great news for the nearly 1 million, as you mentioned, 740,000
yes.
people that are under this the DACA executive action have some good hope ahead.
Yeah.
Omar, so from DACA, we go back to EB5, and we do have until April 28 to find consensus with Congress. But what does that mean? Is April 28 a really hard cutoff line, or is there a possibility it could be extended again?
I do not foresee another extension.
Oh, wow. Really?
I mean, extension without any changes. I think it's been so long, and now we have the new president in place. They've had plenty of time to talk about it. It's all under control of GOP. I think they'll be able to work out something by this April 28th deadline.
Well, that's going to be news indeed. We'll follow on this a little more in later podcasts, because if that's a hard deadline, there's a lot to discuss before it goes ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And any changes that could happen going forward.
Right, right. Anyway, in addition to all of that, USCIS were busy last year. They did a number of things too. Rebecca, there was the wonderful fee increase, which
yes.
I've already indicated. The pain of most immigration lawyers' life in
yes.
December.
So, yes, of course, the USCIS gifted us a new deadline of December 23rd of 2016. The fees did increase for certain applications. So, of course, everyone wanted to get their applications filed. Just a note, I'll give you some examples of what increased. On the EB-5 front, the I-526 did increase from $1,500 to $3,675. Not too major. I-829 stayed the same. I think what the real shocker was the I-924s for regional center applications that increased from $6,230
right.
to a whopping $17,795.
Almost $18,000.
Yes.
Wow.
So tremendous increase. I think, I don't know about Omar Amona, but I think this is to curb how many regional centers are popping up.
Mm-hmm. right. I think it's 900 regional centers now. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that someone's really committed before they apply now.
Exactly.
Because, so if you have a filing fee of $18,000 alone,
mm-hmm.
plus the fact that, Omar, there's a new fee per year now, right, for each firm?
Yes, $3,000. Again, I think to discourage people, too many regional centers from forming, and also to really fund their enforcement efforts and site visits and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So on top of that, they've also, USCIS has updated all their forms. So they are encouraging people to make sure they file with the December 23rd additions. However, they are giving you until February 21st of 2017. They will accept the older additions as long as you file with the new fees. So make sure that you read the directions on their website. The only form that they're not accepting older additions for is the N-400 for citizen naturalization.
Right. But the I-526 form hasn't been changed yet. It was introduced,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you remember, we spent a long time with the Public Policy Committee drafting through all the issues because it became a really long, hefty, complicated form. But I do believe that that has not been finalized yet.
Yeah, no. So the new IFI 26 form that they proposed mid last year, so they have updated the form, meaning the addition date, but they haven't updated it to the new changes that they want to do with the form. So right now it's still the 3-page form that that was previously provided, but it looks like the new form is going to be, if they continue with these changes, will be about 13 pages long.
Yeah, again, it's an issue for really the attorneys are not so much, and nobody else really cares. Yeah. It's more work for us.
Yeah.
But the as far as any investors listening, Rebecca, there was something new introduced relating to processing times, correct?
Yeah, so this recently happened, actually. So I don't know if it's good news because the dates don't really help as much. But now USCIS just announced that instead of showing months as a processing time, so we had, you know, for I-526 is what, 15 months processing time. What they're doing is kind of similar to the visa bulletins. They're putting out a date now. So as of date. So for example, the new date for the I-526 is that they're processing cases right now as of July 12th of 2015. So it's still a backlog. I-29s are being processed as of October 10th, 2014.
But the backlog has continued.
It's exactly.
And it's actually got a lot worse, I believe, right?
Yes, yes. So hopefully USCIS does come out with something that can help with this. But if you see this date, what you can do is if your application is within that range, give USCIS 30 days. You hopefully will have an answer within that 30 days. If not, you can then go ahead and make an inquiry to USCIS.
Hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So do you think they changed it to make it easier for people to understand vice looking at a month backlog and then backing into when they applied versus, you know, putting in their date? Or do you think they've done this to kind of, well, change a metric, vice fix a problem?
I think what they try to, well, they're trying to hope that maybe this is a better way to help individuals figure out, I guess, better processing time. So they'll have a better indication as to when their application should be adjudicated. As far as hopefully they'll implement something else so that the processing times can get faster. But I think this is just maybe easier for applicants to figure out their...
You see, Mark...
Certainly. Yeah, it sounds easier for me to understand.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mark, processing times in EB-5 have really a different relevance or have a different significance than they do in some other areas, mainly because people are emigrating across with their whole families.
Mm-hmm.
Often they're looking at things like putting children into school and stuff. And it's very difficult to plan your life when you're basically picking up your entire life, moving to another country, when you have absolutely no idea mm-hmm. of when you can actually legally move. And so often we have cases where somebody or another has moved here beforehand because they've had to. Maybe it's some deadline or something has happened. And then they're here and they're waiting just for the final processing to go through. And there's delays and backlogs mm-hmm. and, you know, they're really up in a difficult situation.
Yeah, I think with the new dates, what they have as of date, it helps because instead of that month period, what we can say is that now we have an exact date. Here, you said that you're on July 12th of 2015. I submitted my application in February 2015, so I should receive an answer within the next 30 days. I think it gives us more of an indication of when we can expect to see that. And if we don't, then we at least know, okay, now's the time to call USCIS rather than, you know, month after month we've been calling USCIS because the applications weren't coming in time and they couldn't even give us an indication of when we could see an answer from USCIS. So I think maybe this is to help both of us to understand where we are and to understand where USCIS is and maybe give them a little budge to say, hey, we haven't received a response. Let's get it going.
Okay. So in this way, it really, I think, empowers individual action on a case-by-case mm-hmm. level to say, hey, look, theirs was the date. It's been past 30 days. You know, where's my answer?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and that really affects a lot of people. It doesn't affect developers, but it affects almost every investor
mm-hmm.
and, of course, immigration attorneys. And, you know, people need to know.
Yeah. At least we have a better indication. I feel more confident telling my clients, okay, well, here's the date now. But moving forward, just a little update on the visa bulletin. Nothing really much has happened there either. Just the final action dates are at April 8th, 2014. And this is, again, for mainland China, who has the backlog. And the dates for filing are at June 15th, 2014. But again, they haven't helped any way for the adjustment of status stage. So for mainland China, you still have to wait for the final action date. And again, for January, that's April 8th, 2014.
Yeah, we're waiting for the new figures to be released, but we do understand there's been a huge increase in other countries, EB-5 petitions from other countries.
Yes, but I don't think it's going to be nearly as much still as mainland China.
Right. Wow, yeah. So as we can see, USCIS were busy. But Omar, how busy was SEC this year?
So in their year-end report last year, they indicated that they're going to make EB-5 a priority. And in the government accountability report last year, they noted that there were 35 open SEC investigations. It seems a lot of them either went away or are still ongoing.
I was going to ask, 35 open, what does that mean? Does that mean 35 fraudulent cases out there they're investigating or what?
No, it just means that they made inquiries. Maybe they received a complaint from a competitor or a disgruntled employee, and then they looked into it and just had more questions. So it seems most of them are either ongoing or nothing came of it. But there were two major cases that made the news this year. The first one was JPEG, which we heard a lot about, and I think we covered in previous podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also this new case in November in Palm Beach, in which the investors alleged that the principals used the money to buy yachts, luxury cars, and other frivolous items. And they also said that Bill Clinton and Donald Trump were involved in the project, which wasn't true.
Oh, wow. That's pretty... But the good thing is, Omar, is that I think that with all the activity, I think developers are more aware that SEC could just jump into the project or investigate at any time. Is it a random thing?
Usually they get a tip, but the people who give a tip usually don't... A lot of the times don't have the best of intentions. They have a grudge, or they're trying to, get some sort of revenge. So once they get an inquiry, they have to take it very seriously, especially if you remember Bernie Madoff, they received several tips on him, and they never followed it through. So ever since then, they've had this policy of taking everything seriously. And so when you get an inquiry, you need to have, all your documentation showing exactly how you spent the funds ready. And if you have that, you generally done the right thing, it'll go away pretty quickly.
Well, and USCIS can also alert SEC that...
Right. If they receive documents that seem fishy and receive indications that money's not spent the way that they said that it was, then they can send a complaint to the SEC as well.
Right. What do you foresee for 2017?
I see a lot more of the same, a lot more focus. The big cases make the headlines and create pressure. JPEG was in Tom Leahy's home state, which really created a lot of political pressure to, conduct more investigations. As far as legislation, the draft legislation hasn't changed too much from what we saw in 2015 and discussed before, but they have introduced this new account transparency measure, which would require basically have a third party trace all the funds and allow investors to log in and see where their money is at all time until it's actually spent by the project.
The difficulty, I think, is here is that obviously USCIS and the government have to give a certain leeway and independence to the project. And there is such a fine line in many times between what could be considered an SEC violation and what isn't. And I think that developers are becoming more educated on this point.
Right. You need to be aware that, when you're making changes to your business, that you still need to follow the general outline that you put together in your PPM and business plan. That you gave to investors, because it's very difficult for an outside party to tell if you're paying someone a higher salary, is that a legitimate business thing that you need to do, or if it was another way to do fraud.
Right. I mean, obviously, the fraudulent cases really jump out.
Yeah.
If you're going to buy a luxury yacht,
yeah.
That's not usually in the PPM.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Omar. So we know that Congress didn't do too much. USCIS were busy. SEC were busy. But USCIS were busy on more than one front, other than fee increases and in changing of forms. USCIS last year brought out a new policy manual for EB-5.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we don't actually have the proposal regs in front of us. They're not available. But there was a summary that was given on a few points that we can look out to see what changes are made. And I think most people kind of already have an idea of what they're going to be looking at to make changes for 2017.
But Rebecca, if we don't actually have the official regulations, what does that mean? Does that mean that this policy manual is just a sort of taster and there could be more major changes?
Could potentially be. We could be surprised. Maybe USCIS comes out with even more stringent rules. Maybe they change everything altogether. We don't know. But basically, we pretty much know the main areas that they wanted to touch base on, such as TEA.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is that in the TEA, they mentioned a lot of points in the policy manual, which I think a lot of lawyers already know about the qualification of a TEA and that it when a TEA would be effective, for example, at the filing of your petition. But they did not go into some of the controversial areas, which has been the actual changes in the TEA. You know, the controversial changes relating to how wide we could go far, how far we could go, how many census tracts or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like USCIS is trying to, you know, move things along by coming up with their own manual and maybe hoping that Congress will take it a step further and getting all these details fleshed out.
Right. But this manual, I have to say, was sorely needed because it has really laid down the law in some areas, like, for example, Rebecca, in filing requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now they've put three new rules. I mean, one rule is pretty much everyone does that for investors who are already filing. We put all the project documents relating with the RC information. Basically, as a best practice, I think most firms already do that. It's not required at this time, but they're going to go ahead and put that in as a requirement. Another one that they're thinking is that for investors who are filing a Form I-526 with a new project, there's no exemplar or the project documents have not been already submitted, they have to indicate in the petition who they're submitting it's going to be the project document. And they also, which is very interesting, they have to get an affirmative statement from the regional center confirming that they are aware that these project documents are being presented by USCIS. And the third is that when you're filing the I-29, the removal of conditions, 2 years later, you have to submit the business plan and the economic report that was submitted with your I-526 petition.
But don't you currently have to already submit that?
Yes. Well, I guess it's best practices again. We don't know how many attorneys actually do that.
I thought we did, but yeah. People weren't.
Maybe they saw the paperwork coming out of your firm and like, everyone should do this.
Yeah, interesting. They also kind of laid the law down on the return of investment and what's called a redemption agreement. This is something which, again, has confused a lot of people, and you know, people have been doing lots of different things. But it's, understand EB-5, it is quite apparent. An immigrant investor can receive a return on his capital in the form of a distribution of profits or interest. But that interest or that return cannot come into the actual original 500 or however much capital they've already put down, because then that's actually decreasing their minimum amount, which has to stay there. And there was always this gray area as to the redistribution of profits. So I feel like the policy manual does really lay it out.
That is certainly good news, because that's a question that, well, even I get as a non-immigration attorney, but somebody that talks on EB-5 all the time is, what kind of return can I get and when can I get it? And, you know, the advice I've heard from other attorneys has often been conflicting. So it's great that the policy manual is going to address that and clear it up.
Yes, they've actually touched on a lot of areas like job allocation, indirect job creation. You know, I don't really want to go into all of these details, but they really have tried to clarify when and how an economist can actually determine whether the indirect jobs are full-time or not. But the investment of capital is another area that, again, investors and lawyers do get sort of into trouble with, because you are allowed to use loans. But, you know, what kind of loans? So they really laid out the law as far as, for example, a loan from a home, a refinance of a home, how far you can use that. If you have the assets, you know, what collateral can be used. So that's very helpful. And they've also, I believe, Omar, they've also discussed promissory notes as well.
Right. They just really want to make sure that the investor is actually contributing capital to the project and not just having, you know, a paper transaction. That's not really creating jobs. So the main thing they required is that if it's a promissory note, it has to be secured by the investor's assets. So that way we know it's actually the investor has some skin in the game.
Right. I think the other important thing, a really important point that the policy manual does bring out is really discussing what is a material change. Because that concept of material change has been vague. It has been confusing. Even after the May 30, 2013 guidance, I feel like a lot of attorneys still are not quite sure what does come out as a material change or not. And I can tell you, Mark, that we are having a discussion about material change. That came as a request from a developer who wanted us to discuss this, because there was a developer who approached us and he has some commercial buildings and his initial plans didn't actually get zoning. And he had to change a lot of his plan. So he really wanted to know about material change. And he asked us if we could really bring this up in a podcast. So that's interesting.
It sounds like a great topic.
Well, it is, because a lot of people don't really understand it. So it's always good to sort of bring down a difficult topic down to sort of the nitty gritty and be able to discuss it. Omar, the policy manual does refer to the deference in the eligibility requirements at Form I-526 stage.
Right. They did a good thing here and make clear that in the 829 stage, they will give deference to the 526 filing, meaning if there were any changes in rules or regulations in between the time that they received their temporary green card and were waiting for their permanent green card, those rules and regulations won't be a basis to deny the 829. The one thing they will do at the 829 stage, though, is go back and look at the 526 filing and look for any misrepresentations or fraud or any misleading information provided by the investor that they used to obtain the initial approval.
Yeah, we're expecting a number of changes, and maybe, as Rebecca says, that this is just a guideline to Congress to really press forward some of these changes into law.
Yeah, and I think it's really needed. I know we're tired of deadlines. We're like, stop. So hopefully it's not another September 30th after this April deadline. We're hoping for something to come out, and let's hope.
Yes, did you hear that, Mark? Stop.
I did. I'm chuckling because I've heard the deadline. Oh, the deadline's this. Oh, it extended. It's moved. So I think everyone would like these deadlines to stop and say, this is the program and these are the guidelines.
Yeah, it would be helpful just to say this, you know, whatever comes, we'll work with it and just move forward. All right, Mark, so I'm just going to jump in here really quickly. We're going to come off topic again from EB-5. I just want to put it out there that the new H-1B filing date is April 3rd, 2017. You can start filing applications at that time. Unfortunately, it's still at 65,000 visas, so still a lottery system out there, guys.
And probably in a few days, that'll shut down because they've got over twice as many applicants they need, right?
Yeah, probably 5 days.
Well, the one thing is there has been no indication that they are going to increase the H-1B visa quota.
Mm. Yeah, and based off of what's happened recently and probably what will happen in 2017, it doesn't look likely in the near future. Well, Omar, Rebecca, Mona, thank you so much. Normally, I'd give a recap, but I think this entire 2016 year in review, I would just restate everything. So instead, I'll say thank you so much and look forward to talking to you again.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.